Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
I love being a parent, and that's what I think is most surprising, is that I can make room for this thing because I love it so much. I mean, I had one very relatively easy birth and then one very difficult birth, and kind of giving birth is the time when you're closest to death, really. Like, it's like this life and death thing, and it's just so profound. And during that time, I was just so surprised that all I cared about was these children that I had, and I didn't give a whit about my studio practice, so that is something that I've really carried with me going into my life. I'm like, this isn't, whatever happens, successes or failures, I mean, succeeding at being a parent is the most important thing to me, and it's the thing that makes me the most happy.
It's such a joy to welcome Amy Chan to the Artist Mother Podcast today. Amy is an abstract painter and mother in Richmond, Virginia. She currently balances her studio practice while raising her two sons and teaching at the University of Virginia. Her work can be found in the collections of the Rhode Island School of Design Museum, the Spencer Museum of Art in Capital One. Amy has received grants from Pollock Krasner Foundation, the Virginia Commission for the Arts, and more. Amy, I'm so happy to have you. We are in connection because of our mutual friend, Sarah Irvin, who I feel like I bring Sarah up every interview for some reason or another. But thank you so much for being here. I can't wait to talk about your work.
Thank you so much for having me, Kaylin. I love the podcast and I'm happy to be part of it.
Oh, that means a lot. Okay, so let's get started. I want to hear if you've always wanted to be an artist, or what was it that kind of connected you to art and got you to where you are today? Like, what are some highlights along your path?
I have always wanted to be an artist. I was one of those kids, and I came from a family who were not artists at all. So it was very much a path that I had to forge on my own. Mm-hmm. And my parents were always supportive. Everybody in the family was very supportive, but there wasn't really a lot of that going on in the house. So because I had to find things on my own, make opportunities for myself, find what I was interested in, I think it really gave me a sense of autonomy about it. Mm. I mean, in addition to always wanting to do it and just being drawn to that naturally, I feel like the work that I put in at a young age to seek out things and seek out people really helped me even now as an artist, as we all have to find ways to learn things ourselves in our life, mm-hmm. and always be curious. And I think that that at a young age really helped me. I also had a grandmother who was a seamstress, and I spent a lot of time with her. And I do think that color and pattern and just spatial understanding, mm-hmm. that she taught me really kind of kept my interest going beyond just the traditional materials that my parents were able to supply for me, mm-hmm. Kind of just an understanding of making beyond color and paper, which was really important. And then, going to art school and, all that discipline, I was really drawn to that and really never even gave a thought to how to use it in the real world, but it worked out in the end.
Where did you grow up and where did you go to art school?
I grew up in Connecticut, and I went to Rhode Island School of Design, and then I went for master's at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, which is where I live now.
Okay. Well, I want you to describe what your work looks like and kind of what your practice is right now, like, the last couple years. And then I've, of course, looked through your work, and I know there's been some transitions in your practice that I want to talk about. But first, can you describe a little bit about your process and what you're kind of making right now?
Sure. I'm an abstract painter. My materials really guide a lot of what I do. I work with gouache primarily, and that material is so specific to paper panel and also small sizes that ends up being what I use. I enjoy being in congruence with that medium because I love the medium so much. I use a little bit of airbrush, but primarily it's gouache. My abstract forms come from all kinds of places. They're always real things that I look at and draw. Okay. Nature forms, pattern, video games, science, textbooks. I'm always kind of like hunting for shapes. I enjoy kind of finding shapes that have double meanings or remind us of something but never quite say anything specific. Because I'm working in gouache, again, my work is very flat. I enjoy like flat expanses of color, bright color. There's definitely kind of a nostalgic, maybe 80s, 90s feel to it from the time when I grew up.
Yeah. I look at your work and I'm like Miami kind of vibes, you know, like specifically your palette. There's like something about the, I don't know, like 80s, 90s, like beach vibe in your palette that I love.
Yeah. I mean, that was the pinnacle of fashion when I was, when I was a kid, and that really, I mean, thinking about the kind of jams shorts that I wanted,
yes,
that really has never left me. And I love that. I mean, I love that kind of design, and I don't want to, you know, be derivative of that in any way,
right.
But it's always like a reference for me. Yeah. I really enjoy like that kind of color dissonance, like making colors almost not work together, but kind of work together at the same time. That's always kind of in the background. And I mean, going along with that idea of design, humor is really, really a part of my work. It's something, if I'm not having fun or being playful in the studio or optimistic, it's not really working for me.
Yeah.
And in the same way, looking at a finished piece, if it's not somehow fun or sometimes overtly funny, sometimes, you know, very, very undercurrent of that. I don't know. That's sort of my key. I feel like that really makes things click for me.
Yeah.
I also have a very new burgeoning ceramics practice that I'm trying to make some of these shapes that I'm always coming back to into ceramic pieces. And I'm a beginner and I'm seeing where that goes, but I really enjoy it. It's like a really different kind of making.
I want to talk about that and kind of you're dipping your toe in that, but you said something about how there's a lot of shapes that have double meaning and you're like kind of interested in shapes that can reference something, but also like not quite. Mm-hmm. And of course I have your work up and I'm looking at it and I'm like, oh yeah, there's like color wheels, but is that a color wheel? I don't know if that's a color wheel. And then there's like these shapes that almost have like a Bart Simpson head or Pac-Man like head type shape. There's these shapes that they look like fishing bobbers.
Yep.
Like on your more recent work. It's just really cool, like now that you said that, to kind of think through like what am I referencing here when I see these shapes, and what might those multiple meanings be.
Right. Yeah, that was really interesting for me. It's not something I think about specifically, but it's one of those intuitive things that makes it work in the end for me. I'm obsessed with like nature forms, like oak leaves, and especially right now. And I'm constantly trying to draw things that look like oak leaves, but I never want it to look like a leaf. Like I never want it to specifically be that, because that gives it this very specific meaning, which is something I don't want. So I like that weird balance, and never quite getting it is also important too, like kind of having it be a clumsy attempt at making that work is important to me too.
Well, tell me a little bit about the scale of these, because I know a lot of these works are quite small, like 8x10, 11x14, 15. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of a connection to your phase of life right now, making smaller work. Maybe you want to reference like what your studio practice is like. Do you have a lot of space that your studio is taking up, or are you kind of needing your practice to be smaller? Or is that more, no, this is the work I make small work, here's why, you know, kind of.
Yeah, I think I'm in a phase right now that has born from COVID. I mean, my children are 4 and 7, so they were young during COVID. And during that time, I made really small work because it's all I could manage. And I'm like incrementally getting bigger and branching out a bit. But gouache as a medium really only wants to be a certain size. It's kind of hard to make it larger, and that dictates it a bit. Mm-hmm. But really at heart, I think I love paper and I love being able to handle paper and cut it up. And it really wants to be a smaller, manageable size. I also do have a small space right now. I'm working on a studio in my backyard in this great outbuilding, but it is not done yet. No. So I have a small bedroom in my house, which I conform to, and I'm fine with that. You know, I feel that sometimes the bigger work that I've made in the last few years has been for shows, and it's been a different kind of process. It hasn't felt as true to me as like really concentrating on smaller work, but I'm feeling that also start to change. Like I'm feeling itchy a while in a small space. You start to feel itchy to make some bigger work. So
yeah, on your website, the work from 2019 is more like 48 by 36. And then if you click on the 2020 works, which I love this page of works. It looks like you did a 6x6 series during 2020 during COVID.
Oh yeah, that was that was a rough time. But I actually am really surprised to see how much work I made. I mean, my children were 1 and 3. Oh my gosh! And so it was madness in my house. And I did I just cut 6x6 pieces of paper and allowed myself literally to go in for 10 minutes at a time if I could make it. And that actually worked out for me. I was feeling like it was going to be sort of a nothing year, but working small and using collage is really exciting for me because, again, it goes to that playfulness and humor and constant changing. So I really do like making large series of small work. I've continued that. I've got some going on now because I enjoy that 6x6 so much.
Was going to say the collage element to this body of work, I think, is so strong. And I know many artist parents are drawn to collage because it is a process that you can kind of pick up and put down and start, stop, and be interrupted. So just seeing how strong your hand was with that, you know, during the COVID lockdown and you had a 1 and 3 year old, it's like, this makes sense. And also, it's like so good.
Thank you. I'm a big recycler of artwork. I really don't let work sit. If it's in my possession, it doesn't last long. I'll recycle things and be really irreverent about old work. So I do have a constant stream of collage material, which is exciting to me. I like the feeling of being able to recycle things into collage.
Do you kind of use paper, you know, from the mail or like things that are found around your home, or is it more like studio-based collected stuff?
Yeah, it's always studio-based collected stuff. I think I've had it drilled into me. Art school is like archival, archival, yes. Archival. So I feel like I can't use it. But on top of that, I'm just interested in like, I'll do printmaking, you know, practice work and cut those up. They're never quite what I want. And so anything in the studio is usually my collage material.
Okay. And when you make work like the 6x6 series, and then, you know, the more recent work that you've been made, you're making it on paper, but then mounting it to panel always, or no?
No, I make it on paper, and panel work I do directly on the panel. I use prepared panels that are smooth, basically as smooth as paper, almost the same. So,
So tell me about this transition to ceramics, because now I have these beautiful ceramic pieces in front of me, and I'm like, What kind of inspired you to, you know, go 3D with the shapes that you're making, and how did that, you know, kind of come into your process? Like, was it, did you take a workshop? Is there another artist that you asked, hey, can you teach me how to do this? What was kind of your jumping off point there?
Well, my friend Debbie Quick is a master ceramicist, and she runs Clayground Studio here in Richmond. And she has been asking me for years and years, you know, you need to try to, you would do great making these into ceramics. These shapes would really work. You should try it. And I hadn't taken her up on it, but during the pandemic, again, when she opened her new studio, I took her up on it, and she's been this amazing teacher, has really taught, I mean, from nothing. I had never done ceramics before, and she taught me everything. And I am still so beginner. I think mostly because I'm not as interested in the technical part of ceramics. Right. I mean, she really helps me with that. So therefore I can only advance to a certain level, because I need to build things in a certain way in order for them not to explode and crack. But the flat pieces, I find it so exciting just to isolate shape. Mm-hmm. It's like almost thinking about making shaped paintings, which I have done in the past, but it's really labor intensive. You have to cut wood and sand and prepare. But with ceramics, it's so quick to make shape. And so it's almost like cooking, you know, it's like just such a natural.
There is definitely like a cookie cutout feel to these, which is like, you know, like holiday cookie time is like the best, because you're just taking these shapes and punching the dough out. And yeah, I love that feeling.
Yeah, I love the way it feels. It's like the squishy, pliable process that I'm just not used to. And it also gave me a chance to use all the weird found objects that I collect. I collect found objects that are mainly building material, like hardware, weird pieces of metal or plastic that I find. And I started to be able to use those as sort of texture makers. So a lot of them have tools and shapes that I've collected as part of the texture. I use like my kids' toys. I use Legos as texture sources. So there's like Lego prints on a lot of them. And yeah, it's just a wonderful process. And I feel like I'm ready to go back to it. I've come to like a stopping point, as I said, because truly getting three-dimensional has been very hard for me technically. Okay. So I stopped for a little while, but it's still in the back of my mind. And I love how it comes and goes with interplay with the work that I'm doing on paper as well.
Yeah, I love them and how they're, like you said, how they're interplaying. I love that these install images of the collaboration with Debbie, you know, where there's like painted wall shapes and then kind of your ceramics, and they're just in this like playful arrangement. There's so much dimension there. It's really cool to see even them interacting with like a corner. I always love like corner installations, that because there's kind of this intense like moment that can happen between, you know, like your spatial understanding of the work being right up against a wall on other work, you know, and I don't know, there's something about that that is really interesting to me.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, wall painting and using spaces like corners, as you were saying, has always been something that has been interesting to me. I've done it sort of few and far between, but working with a three-dimensional medium puts it right there. So it's very, very accessible. Mm-hmm. Using shape, I mean, once you have shaped pieces to hang, you automatically think about using a shaped space and using shaped backgrounds for it. Yeah, so it really opens up a lot of things that working on a rectangle does not. So
did you keep the ceramic process at that studio, or did you start making ceramics at home? Like, kind of practically, how did you integrate ceramics into your very, you know, 2D paper and paint process?
Yeah, I do work at the studio. That's a very separate thing for me, because I don't want to bring the mess or the breakability home. Mm-hmm. And she has everything there that I need. It's, again, it's like going back to the novice thing. I also like to be able to turn my head and ask her a question.
Yeah.
Because that's really important for making technical work.
Awesome. And then tell me about your home studio. Like you said, you're working on a backyard space right now. You're kind of just in this little spare bedroom, it sounded like. Is that the kind of space that you keep the door closed and your kids aren't allowed to go in there? Is it integrated? Like you're kind of always pulling stuff out into the living room. Like what are kind of your boundaries around studio and domestic space? Or lack of boundaries.
Yeah, I definitely have boundaries. And to be honest, I'm surprised that my children have respected them so far. Mm-hmm. But they, as I said, so they're 4 and 7 boys right now. And they are, I don't really work with them in the studio. They can't, they're, everything will be touched by them if they're in my studio.
Right.
Things are going to be investigated. And so it's very, it's very much a separate space. It has to be, I really only work in here when they're not home because they want to be with me. They want to hang out and they want to come in, which is fine for a little while, but we don't really, I don't really join that at all. So therefore maximizing the time when they're not here is really, really important to making a studio practice. I think that that's going to change. I can sort of start to see that changing as they mature. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, we just got out of the grabby kind of phase with them.
Yes.
And also it's not a safe place either. I don't really want them. They want to touch the colorful things, which are not necessarily safe for them. So,
right.
Yeah, I do kind of keep it separate. And once I have a space in the, a larger space, I think that'll be even more seamless.
Are you guys building a standalone, like a shed or something, or what is it, like a garage that you're renovating? What's kind of the process?
We have this great shed. It's almost like an outbuilding. I don't even want to call it a shed. It's like an outbuilding that was here when we bought it. And it's basically, it's been drywalled, painted, ready for electricity. And we just, so we're close. I'm close.
Okay.
it doesn't have any heat or air conditioning, but that's fine. Yeah. But it's very close to being ready.
Okay.
It's going to be a great studio.
Well, I'm excited for you to get that space up and running. Because even that, the separation of it's in my home or it's just outside of my home is like a really nice, you know, separation. My ideal is a detached backyard studio. Mm-hmm. I think it's just
I've seen on your Instagram pictures of your studio, and I feel like what we've got going is very similar to what I see from yours. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a big space. It was a one-car garage that kind of had, I mean, we could barely pull in like our Nissan Sentra. So it was a very small one-car garage, but then it had this little half shed kind of built onto it. So it's like a 1.5 car garage. And yeah, it took, you know, some downsizing of like outdoor stuff that we just like, we're, you know, like where's the mower gonna go, and like kind of figuring all that out, like where are bikes gonna go, and you know, we're constantly kind of keeping our stuff at a minimum in certain areas so that we can have this space that's like my studio, you know. But I think, yeah, it's just a great scenario. I've thought about like renting a space downtown, or, you know, kind of looking for like an off campus space. And I don't know, I really like the flexibility of, I still have my lukewarm cup of coffee and I can just walk out there and, you know, for a couple hours, or I can put a load of laundry in and like come back 2 hours later and hang it up to dry, you know, like kind of that in and out of studio mode is really nice. I like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've learned to like it. I have had studios in various places outside of the home, and I always thought that's what I enjoyed, because I enjoyed the energy of communal spaces. But yeah, with kids, there's really no substitute for being able to jump in there for 20 minutes. I mean, talking about the work that I did during COVID, that wouldn't have been able to happen if I didn't have that space right there.
Well, what kind of childcare is happening for your kids while you're, you know, kind of getting that studio time? I also know you teach. So do you want to talk a little bit about kind of the balance of how often you're in the studio and how often you're teaching and where your kids are during that time? And I'm assuming your 7-year-old is probably at school, but your 4-year-old maybe has just started. Talk a little bit about that kind of practical scheduling of things.
Yeah, I'm a teacher. And so my studio and my job work, I feel like, is becoming very seasonal, which is working out fine for me, actually. During the school year, my son is in second grade, and then my other son is in pre-K. So they are gone most of the day. Okay. I teach Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And so I do have 2 days where I've got a good chunk of day to work. Mm-hmm. But even still, there's all the things that need to be done. There's like laundry and grocery shopping. It kind of eats away, and also taking time for myself, you know, having a workout or seeing friends. It's amazing how those things can eat away at that one studio day that you have and leave you with a few hours. So I do view summer as my main work period. It's been that way for a number of years for me. Doing sort of mini residencies when I can, and just capitalizing on them being away at camp or childcare. I've been able to kind of squish everything into summer break, spring break, and winter break. And in the semester time when I'm working at my job, I do a lot of just percolating, thinking, sketchbook, and sort of allowing myself to find things that make me excited, find things that make me happy in my studio without any consequence, and trust that those will then crystallize when I have time to be in the studio, which they always do. I'm not an everyday worker. I wish that I was. I wish that I was that person who could go in for 2 hours in the morning, but I don't have something 2 hours in the morning. It doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. I like letting things kind of build up and build up. And that thankfully works along with an academic teaching schedule right now.
Yeah. I am definitely embracing that seasonal rhythm more for my studio practice too. And I don't know if it's just a cultural expectation that like the best artists are in there every day. You know, I think that's like an American, we work hard at something, we put all of our effort in. And I feel that kind of hanging over me a lot of the time, like, oh, if I'm really serious about this, I need to, you know, pound the pavement. And like, yes, but also I really care about my lifestyle as an artist as much as necessarily making like a ton of work, you know. I feel like kind of what you were saying about just having time and space to be a human, and that also produces a more nourishing mental experience for me as an artist. Like, and I feel like you were kind of thinking about or speaking to that too, like that, you know, studio time often is as much in your head as, you know, actually being in there making stuff with paper. And so if you're, you know, if you're just grinding all the time, there's not often that space to process and critically think about things. And I think that's been something I've been trying to create more space in my life for, especially the past couple of years, kind of post-COVID. It's like every moment doesn't have to be filled, you know?
Yeah, I definitely see it as a benefit rather than a detriment at this point. I feel like when I think about something and I have to wait in order to manifest it, it makes me want it more. It makes me want to do it more. I'm more excited about it. And I can visualize it more clearly by the time that moment comes. So I definitely would love to have more studio time, but I take it as a good thing in a lot of ways, because I see, you know, year after year it's played out, and I have been able to continue work while having children. So I'm starting to trust that rhythm a lot more now.
Sometimes for me, I find when I have that space of thinking through an idea and I can't just jump on it immediately, I realize it's not a very good idea.
Yes.
You know, it's not always that it becomes clearer and better the more I think about it. I think about it and I'm like, what was I thinking? Like, that is so not going to work, you know?
Yeah.
So it kind of goes both ways.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Having your studio process, acknowledging that a lot of times it's in your head is really powerful, because then you take it everywhere you go and it feels like you're doing, it feels like you're doing something. Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by the Thrive Together Network. TTN is a virtual community I run for women artists. We have a space right on the network for artist caregivers to connect, and it is truly my favorite place on the internet. Every Tuesday, I co-host a session called Art and Tea, where our community comes together to connect as artists. We share our goals and provide accountability for each other and talk about lots of topics artists deal with, ranging from how to put on an exhibition, organization tips for your studio, ways to manage stress, and so much more. The Thrive Together Network is an inclusive platform for artists, and so much is included in your membership. It's crazy. We offer 2 virtual art residencies a year to help you stay on track with your studio goals. We have an exhibition program called Taking Up Space, those Tuesday art and tea sessions that I mentioned. We have monthly workshops on art business, art writing. We even have a book club. Plus, there's hundreds of artists to connect with from all over the world. Because of the Artist Mother partnership with TTN, we have a discount code for you, just for artist caregivers to join the network. You can take $10 off your monthly membership fee for the Thrive Together Network, but your best deal is actually if you sign up for a year with us, commit to a whole year of joining us and joining our programming, and you'll save over $140 on your membership. So head to www.artistmotherpodcast.com/network to learn more and check it out. Membership comes with a free 2-week trial too, so you can truly get in there and see what you think before you actually commit to becoming a member. Just a reminder, on the network, we have a special group for artist caregivers where we have intentional conversations about our roles and identity as artists who are making work and balancing all of the caregiving that we do. We even have quarterly meetups for this group for deeper times of connections. I would really love to get to know you on the network, see more about your work and your art practice, and just connect with you in this amazing, compassionate, intentional, and encouraging community of female artists. We are all about providing resources to help you grow your art career, and this effort is combined with tools and the means to connect with the artists who are on a similar path, who are doing similar things with their careers. So once again, you can head to artistmotherpodcast.com/network to learn more, to get our discount code, and to join the Thrive Together Network. Well, Amy, let's chat a bit more about your experience becoming a parent. I'm wondering if, you know, since your kids are on the younger age, same ages as my kids, the experience of actually giving birth and becoming like this season of becoming, right? Becoming a mom, becoming, creating life and bringing it into the world. I think that experience for me was so profound and connected to, you know, my artist identity in ways that I didn't realize. I'm wondering if that was the same for you, if you felt like, you know, childbirth or becoming a mom really connects to your studio practice.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of a single thing in my life that having a child has not changed. It's literally everything that has changed. And then and there's a certain way that you have to walk around pretending that nothing has changed, which is really interesting. But yeah, I mean, I had one, well, first of all, I had my children later in life. So I was 37 and 40 with my two boys. And so a lot of that change for me is coming about because now I'm suddenly, after the first harrowing years of having young kids, I'm suddenly a mom, but also in midlife, like middle age. So that affects it as well. So I feel like that part of it, plus being a parent, plus trying to organize my life around that and still do everything, is just incredibly, really life-changing. I mean, I think for me, it has changed the way I work. As I mentioned, you know, the kind of work that I do, the size of the work that I do, the amount of time I'm able to spend with it. But I'm surprised that I don't feel bitter about that. Like, if I had thought about that before I had children, I would have been, you know, frustrated. And if I had envisioned how little time I have to do my work right now, it would have been very frustrating to me. But I'm not, I don't know. I love being a parent. And that's what I think is most surprising, is that I can make room for this thing because I love it so much. I mean, I had one very relatively easy birth and then one very difficult birth. And kind of giving birth is the time when you're closest to death, really. Like, you can, you know, you can, it's like this life and death thing. And it's just so profound. And during that time, I was just so surprised that all I cared about was these children that I had. And I didn't give a whit about my studio practice, you know. So that is something that I've really carried with me going into my life. I'm like, this isn't, you know, whatever happens, successes or failures, I mean, succeeding at being a parent is the most important thing to me. And it's the thing that makes me the most happy. And so that, like, really takes a lot of the edge off, honestly, about being an artist. It's like, I want to find the things that make me happy and that can support this other part of my life, which is my family. And that makes it a lot easier, and the path is a little bit more clear too. And then it's, as I said, has changed everything about my life. It's given me incredible multitasking skills, balancing skills. I've cut out a lot of things, and but I'm a lot healthier now overall. And I think that that is really, really important for everything.
I love the word that I feel like you're kind of framing this all in for me is perspective, right? Like, your perspective has really changed. And I think that is probably very specific to artists who have, you know, 10, 15 years into their art career before they become a parent. Because for me, I basically decided to become an artist after I was already a parent. You know, I had another job before then that was related, but, you know, committing to going back to grad school, like, I already had a kid. And so that artist identity that, you know, I know for years, you know, you were kind of, that was your thing, like, that was your number one, you know, to kind of have that experience of putting so much time and effort into that career, into your work, and then have such a shift. I just have so much, like, respect and admiration for that. And you made the comment that, like, you feel healthier now than ever before. Like, do you want to just touch on that a little bit more? Like, what is it, because you had to change your perspective, like, you had to really prioritize what's important? Like, why do you feel healthier now?
Yeah, it's definitely about prioritizing. I have had to divide up my life into a lot more self-care than I had performed before, because I've seen that I can't keep doing this without taking care of myself. I mean, I'm a champion napper since having children, and I have all the self-care that revolves around sleep. I let myself take a nap very often, and that makes me feel really good. And I eat a lot better. I'm like, it's like I have to think about everything and plan everything that's going to be good in my life, like taking care of myself, going for a walk, going for a workout. There's so much planning that's involved because you have to have someone taking care of the kids. So I do it more. So mm-hmm. I feel like my body is healthier. I feel like my habits are healthier and much more balanced mm-hmm. in general, which is surprising. Mm-hmm. I'm still extremely, you know, busy and frantic every day, but I do realize what's important at this point. And I'm able to have a little bit more of that perspective on what I don't need in mm-hmm. my life.
Mm-hmm. I think that is interesting that so many of us, you know, the more constraints we have on our time, the better we are at kind of figuring out what's important. And that's not always the case for everybody, especially, you know, folks who are not well supported and folks who don't have as many resources. But I think there is something interesting about, you know, kind of, I have all the time in the world and therefore I'm not going to make very healthy choices. I'm just going to kind of waste it. And then I only have, you know, this finite or this limited amount of time and I'm going to get as much out of it as I can, you know, kind of that shift that happens is really interesting.
Yeah. It makes you more efficient at everything. I mean, mm-hmm. added to that, I feel healthier now because I had, for both of my pregnancies, I had gestational diabetes mm-hmm. and I had to completely overhaul my diet. At the time I was like, I can't do this. This is the worst. And now I've just gotten used to it. If you have gestational diabetes, you're at really, really high risk of getting type 2 diabetes. So mm-hmm. you basically have to continue to eat this very restricted diet for the rest of your life if you want to stay out of type 2 diabetes. And so I do that and it has made me so much healthier. I mean, just, I have to really think about my diet and fruits and vegetables all the time, which is great.
Yeah. Well, Amy, a couple more questions for you before we wrap up. I'm wondering, back to kind of your art practice, where do you feel like you've had some big successes and like, what does success really mean to you as an artist? You can speak to that more holistically just as an artist parent or as a person if you want. But I'm curious about kind of, you know, you have a lot on your plate being a parent, you are a professor, and also you have this beautiful art practice and career. And so for you, where do you feel successful in kind of, you know, the balance of those, especially as an artist?
Yeah, that moving target has changed for me a lot over the years. I'm one of the people who I felt like I had a good amount of success early in my career. And when I lived in New York, it was a little bit faster paced in terms mm-hmm. of more traditional gallery showing. And since I moved here for grad school and teaching, that has changed a little mm-hmm. bit. And that was hard for me to work with for a little while. But now that I have children, my idea of success has, of course, completely changed. I think that balance is the main point that I would try to work for. I mean, balance is success to me at this point. I know that I have so many things in my life that I want to keep, my art practice and a thriving art practice at that being mm-hmm. really important. So just being able to maintain that balance and have all the things I want, even if they're in small quantities, that mm-hmm. that feels like success to me. And I feel like some days I'm having success and some days I am not at all. So mm-hmm. It's just really changed, and it's changed so much in like 10 or 15 years that I'm expecting that to change again. You know, I mm-hmm. think that it's always the idea of what I want and what makes me feel successful will probably take another shift in 10 to 15 mm-hmm. years from now.
I think something I've been learning about balance goes back to what we were talking about earlier in kind of accepting seasonal, you know, flows to your work. It's, I think when we hear the word balance and you know, many of us kind of have a bad taste in our mouth about that word because it's just been so overused and kind of put on particularly women in like, oh, to be a balanced woman, you have to do XYZ and all this stuff. But I think when we think of that word, at least I think of, you know, kind of things being in balance all the time. Like every moment there is this like equilibrium, but really, you know, part of me becoming more balanced has been, no, this season is for this thing and I have to put the other thing behind me right now. And I will trust that it will come back. And then, you know, it really is more like a big picture balance, you know, and kind of accepting that like things need more time and I can't do it all at once. I have to kind of move in and out of these states of focus, you know, which always means setting something aside so that you can give more to one area.
Yeah. And setting something aside requires you to let go of something mm-hmm. that is usually really important, which is hard to do, but mm-hmm. an important skill to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what are you working on in the studio or just with your career? Do you have any goals that you're kind of, you know, working on for the next 6 months or a year? Is there a show that's coming up? Are you imagining a big body of work? Are you just trying to get that studio built and then see what happens? What's kind of next for you as an artist?
Yeah, well, we're recording this at the end of summer, and I just finished what I would say is my most intensive period for a while. I have a show coming up at Sweetbriar College, which is in Virginia, in Amherst, Virginia. It's right across the way from the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, the VCCA, if any of your listeners have ever been there as a resident. Yeah. And so I just finished a whole bunch of work for that, and that was a real big push. And so now I feel like I'm moving into my rest and exploration phase, and I've got a whole bunch of messy watercolors and ink stuff out and ready to just play a little bit and not worry too much. I always feel like going into the holiday season is just a big family activity kind of time. And so I usually try to lighten things if I can. But that show opens on September 29th. So I'm excited to see how that show goes and just kind of find some exciting, fun things in the studio and see where that goes in the next year or so.
Yeah. I was going to ask you too, if your practice, like how you stay engaged in your practice in sort of the lower seasons. I was wondering if photography is part of your practice, because you mentioned, you know, you kind of take shapes that you find and, you know, like a leaf or like a weird toy or whatever, and you kind of pull it into your practice. I should have asked this earlier, but do you take photos of those things? Like, is that kind of a way to, like a looking and a thinking, a collecting, does that become part of your practice? You mentioned watercolors and inks. Like, I'm curious about the kind of light studio work that you're doing during these slower seasons.
I don't usually take photography. I'll do it in a pinch, but usually I rely on drawing. I try to keep a sketchbook going at all times. And that's my go-to for recording things. I find that for the work that I do, until I draw the shape, I can't really understand it. So that's really integral to like me processing it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I keep a pretty rigorous sketchbook. I usually have two or three going at one time. And they're really invaluable to me. I was just talking to my students about sketchbooks and how sketchbooks can be a very private thing. And a lot of artists don't really show them. They're this huge, sometimes huge amount of work that you make that is just for you. And that's the way it is for me. It's just purely research and drawing.
Awesome. All right. Anything you're currently working on as a parent? What is happening in parent life? Any big milestones coming up that you're like, I just got to get through this?
Oh, gosh. I want everybody to sleep in their own beds. That's a big
relatable.
Oh, yeah, everybody to sleep in their own beds and go to bed at the right hour. We don't have any time to like watch movies as a couple at night. We're just like bedtime and like carrying kids around at this point. So that's my biggest goal.
I love that. I need to ask that question more often because it's so relatable when you realize everybody's working on something right now, you know? Nobody has it all figured out. Like,
yeah. And as soon as you get that figured out, like a new phase comes up and it's just a whole new thing.
Well, before we do our final five to close our conversation, Amy, I didn't want to forget to plug that you are the visiting artist for Sarah Irvin's Crit Crew group, which enrollment is now open for our Crit Crew program that happens through the Thrive Together Network. At the time of this episode, enrollment will be open. It's possible you're in Sarah's group may have already sold out. We'll see. Hopefully not. There's hopefully a chance to still get to work with Amy, but Sarah is the main mentor of that group. She's also an artist in Richmond who we just adore. And we gave Sarah a shout out at the beginning of this episode. But Amy is going to be the visiting artist who's going to come and work with Sarah's group and, you know, kind of give feedback and do it in a thoughtful and generous way, just like this conversation happened, the tone of this conversation. So if you're interested in hearing Amy's take on your work and her thoughts, definitely sign up to work with Sarah and Amy this fall. It's a 9-week program, small group mentorship of artists, female identifying artists, many of whom are caregivers. So that program is currently enrolling. You can find more information at thrivetogethernetwork.com to sign up. Amy, final five. You ready?
Yes.
All right. Who is your biggest art crush?
Right now, I have to say Katherine Bernhardt. I mean, going back to the 80s, 90s aesthetic, mm-hmm. I just saw a show of hers in the spring. And I'm in love with all that she does. And she just had her house featured on the New York Times Magazine, which is crazy. My like endearing always art crush is Jennifer Bartlett. And she has her Rhapsody work up at the MoMA right now. I've been coming back to her work really since undergrad. Love everything that she does. Yeah.
Okay. Favorite place to travel or a dream trip you'd like to go on?
Dream trip. I think that my husband and I are really gunning to go to Japan at some point in our lives. It's not in plans right now, unfortunately. A place that I love to travel, though, I want to make a plug for our residency program that we run at UVA Mountain Lake Biological Station, which is a wonderful place. We in the mountains of Southwest Virginia. I love going there almost every summer now. For artists who make work that has to do with science or nature. It's a really wonderful place.
Great shout out. Artists, look that up. Okay. Tell me a film or a book that has been a big inspiration to you.
I am a big fiction reader. I always am reading fiction. And Haruki Murakami is one of my favorite contemporary writers. Trilogy of the Rat, which is a 3-book series, is probably one of my favorite contemporary fiction books. Awesome. It's just like such a weird space of like kind of what I think about in my paintings, real life, but then like abruptly, abruptly disrupted by these dream spaces. It's a really, really fantastic trilogy.
Great. I love fiction. So gonna look that up. Okay. Favorite meal.
Well, I come from a immigrant family. My mom is Italian. My dad is Chinese. And so on both sides, noodles of any kind. I'm going to say I could never narrow it down of any kind, really.
Yes, I know. That is the best food combo right there. Oh my gosh. Just give me all the forms of pasta and noodles.
Comfort food.
Okay. And who do you want to give a shout out to for supporting you and your work?
Well, my parents, who have always been supportive of everything. And currently my husband, we have a reciprocal support network of, you know, being each other's cheerleaders and taking care of the kids and just making sure that we each have what we need to make our work.
What does your husband do for a living?
He works at Virginia Commonwealth University, but he is also an artist and he writes. He's an artist and writer and he writes role-playing games.
Ooh, so very cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, Amy, where can folks find you? Where is, you know, the best place to connect with you? Are you on Instagram? What's your website?
So my website is www.amychan.org and my Instagram is amychanartist.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for a great conversation. And again, if you want to work with Amy this fall and Sarah Irvin, you can find out more about their Crit Crew group at thrivetogethernetwork.com. Amy, thank you.
Thank you so much, Kaylin. It's been great to be on the podcast.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.